Now, just before we go into that, then, if I can just deal with some news analysis, some news updates. And I think, again, we'll try and take a particular issue. And the issue that I'd like to take today is the extradition that has just come up of Abu Hamza. Now, Abu Hamza was a cleric, a Muslim cleric in London, and he had a mosque in London, and he was actually thrown out of his mosque. I'm not sure all the details that actually happened, but it was closed down because of the things that he was saying. He was advocating terrorism and so on. So he then set up outside the mosque, and the British have not actually been able to go ahead and close him down legally until literally this past week. And this particular article is coming from yesterday and Friday. It says the extradition could be delayed for years. So even though he is actually in custody now, it says the arrest of Abu Hamza, clearly choreographed by London and Washington yesterday, is the start of an extradition process that could take months, if not years. The hook-handed cleric will join a lengthening list of foreign terrorist suspects in British jails awaiting deportation while lawyers argue over their fate. Some have been in custody since the late 1990s. So, these legal processes do take such an incredible length of time. John Ashcroft, America's Attorney General, indicated at a press conference in New York that at least one charge against Hamza carried the death penalty. Yet before Britain even agrees an extradition, it must be satisfied under European human rights law that the suspect will not or could not face capital punishment in the country issuing the warrant. This is a rule of the British extradition. And unless we're absolutely happy, the authorities are happy that this will not happen and cannot happen, they will not release the suspect. David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, said that while the Americans were entitled to pass the death penalty, there was an agreement that they would not carry it out. However, this is an obvious weakness that will be exploited by Hamza's lawyers as they seek to prevent his extradition, and they will also question why he cannot be tried in Britain, given that some of the charges alleged by the Americans, including assisting terrorists abroad, clearly fall under the British anti-terrorist legislation. And the question is, well, why couldn't it have actually happened, years ago? Because the terrorism that he's being accused of actually took place in the Yemen some years ago. And on the front page of that same paper, that was yesterday's paper, in fact, it was Hamza the terrorist consultant. The cleric is held in a top security jail as the US starts the extradition fight. Again, it goes into the fact that it had to have written assurances from America that he wouldn't be executed. It was almost impossible, if you like, for him to be executed. Now, if we just turn over to Genesis 9, this is the time of Noah. And in Genesis 9, verse 6, it starts really the kind of legal situation for the time and the age in which we find ourselves today, and the way that the courts of the land should, in fact, make judgments, because these are human courts, and it's been put into the hand of man. And it says in verse 6 of Genesis 9, it says, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man." So notice, I want you to notice that it wasn't just a case that he should be executed, it is by man shall his blood be shed. And this is extended to things like kidnapping and adultery and various other things as well within the law. But part of the reason for the problems here in the UK, as far as why he wasn't extradited or why he wasn't prosecuted before, there's an article here in today's paper which talks about the phone tapping. Now, some of you in America will probably think it's quite bizarre that we can have laws like this. But it says Home Office dithering over a decision on whether to permit the use of phone tap evidence in court emerged yesterday as the key reason, or a key reason, why Abu Hamza could not be tried in Britain. So, in other words, the use of phone tapped material is not valid in a British court. Now, I I find it kind of hard to believe, but nevertheless, it says, although the government has said for years that it was reviewing the prohibition on intercept evidence and was minded to lift the ban, it is yet to produce firm proposals. And David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, conceded yesterday that evidence in American hands allegedly linking the extremist Muslim cleric to the kidnap and murder of hostages in Yemen would not have been admissible in British courts because it was obtained from intercepting satellite phone calls. And if you basically go on and read a little bit more about that, you find that part of the reason as well is that in order to present it into a British court, there's such openness that has got to take place, it would jeopardise MI5. And MI5 and their techniques in obtaining the satellite phones and this kind of material would have to therefore come out in court, and actually MI5 is against it. So there's all this kind of balancing act as well that's got to be taken into account. So there's an awful lot more behind this particular case than meets the eye. Now, at the same time all of this was going on, there's another case over in Australia about a witness that was there. She's called Joanne Lees, and she and her boyfriend were driving through the Australian outback, and a car broken down, and they stopped, and as far as they can tell, although the body has never been found, her boyfriend was murdered, and according to Joanne Lees, she was handcuffed by this particular individual, and she managed to escape, and then some lorry drivers found her in a distressed state, and she then identified the person who in fact did this. And it says here, Joanne Lees admitted yesterday that she was having sex with another man in the weeks before her boyfriend, Peter Falconio, disappeared in the Australian outback. Miss Lees, 30, said that in the days after Mr. Falconio's murder in July 2001, she discussed meeting the man known only as Nick in Berlin, and she was appearing for the third day as a committal hearing at Darwin Magistrate Court. So what in fact the defence is doing is trying to dispute her evidence by showing that she's not trustworthy, that, you know, she was actually cheating on this boyfriend anyway, so it was something that really she shouldn't go ahead and be listened to. Now, there is again, when we are looking at it from a church perspective, the subject of making judgments, if you turn over to Deuteronomy 17, there are a number of scriptures that we do need to keep in mind. And again, this all has a bearing on the way in which we need to be judging in the future, because we will be kings and priests. Now, the law is not going to be exactly the same way as this law is here. The law will be very, very similar, but there will be, I was going to say leniency. Leniency is the wrong word. There is, in fact, the possibility of having a sin completely wiped out, and the penalty, therefore, completely removed, and it will be removed by the king. Much as the way as people get amnesty today, and the king at that time, of course, would be Christ, who paid the penalty on all of our behalves. But within the law, which is also given by Christ, by the same being, over here in Deuteronomy chapter 17, in verse 6, it says, "At the mouth of two witnesses, or three witnesses, shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death." Now, the only one there was this particular lady called Joanne Lees, and she is therefore giving the version as to who it was and so on. Now, you say, well, therefore he should be set free. And well, that's not true, no, because there's other witnesses as well, and the witnesses are the forensic scientists that have also discovered on her, I think a t-shirt, blood, which is almost certainly come from this particular suspect. In other words, when she was grappling with him, she obviously scratched him or something, and some blood went onto her t-shirt, and that then was used to link that man with the event that took place. So there's more than one witness there. So you now have at least two witnesses. And so when you come into this area of witnesses and the actual making of judgments, you can certainly see that this can be applied in that particular case. And if you read around this, however, there's an aspect that is not being applied, because it says here, well, there's several aspects. First of all, if you notice what it actually says, it says in verse 2, it says, if there be found among you with any of your gates which the Eternal your God gives you, man or woman that has wrought wickedness in the sight of the Eternal your God in transgressing his covenant, in other words, going against the word of God and the agreement that has been made to be subject to the laws of God, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped then either the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven which you have not commanded. So again, this is something that is not applied within, I mean, this particular lady here could be a witch or whatever. It would not be a punishable offense, you know, whatever. Anybody can virtually believe whatever they like. But he says, and it be told you, and you have heard of it, and inquire diligently, and behold, it's true, and the thing certain that such abomination is wrought in Israel, then you'll bring forth that man and woman which has committed that wicked thing to your gates, even the man and the woman, then you will stone them with stones till they die. So the execution was to be done by stoning. Now we'll go on and we'll just see a little bit more of that in a moment. The mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but the mouth of one witness he will not be put to death. So one witness was not sufficient, and yet in today's society that sometimes is transgressed. The, you know, circumstantial evidence plus one witness is sufficient, and that is not the case in God's system. The hands, then here is another aspect though. So not only were they to be stoned as the form of execution, it says, we just read in Genesis, by the hand of man shall the blood be, you know, that the blood be punished. It says, the hand of the witnesses shall be the first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hands of all the people, so you shall put an evil away from among you. Now this again is not the way people are executed today. So there's a great deal about, as far as the law of God is concerned, that is not being applied. Now if you want to find a little bit more out about the way this was done, you've got to go to Jewish circles. And in Mishnah, apparently Mishnah 4, section 1, and if you want, you know, you can actually find this on the internet. I pulled this off the internet, a kind of comment on it. So section 1 of Mishnah 4, it says, according to the rabbis, stoning was not carried out by throwing stones at the person till he dies. It's not the way it was done, which would seem to be the normal way that one would understand stoning. Rather, the person is pushed off a two-story platform, and then stones are dropped on him. So he was actually put onto a two-story platform outside the city, presumably from the, perhaps the wall of the city, which would be made a certain height, and there was a certain specified height that that had to take place. The first witness is the one that pushed him off, and he, if he dies, then the execution is over and there's no further stoning done. So there's the first witness, the primary witness. If the person is still alive, then the second witness throws a stone on him, and the stone is quite large. In the other places it talks about how the basically what they're doing is aiming for the heart. And so the execution is very, very quick as far as this actual, the way it was applied. If he dies, the execution is over. So in other words, this again, this was the second stage. If he remains alive, then the rest of Israel throw stones at him. And the process is based on a biblical verse, which we've got up there. We should note two things. First of all, that the Mishnah is careful to stone the person only until he dies. Once he dies, the rabbis forbid further disfiguration of the body. And second, the Torah requires that the witnesses to take part in the stoning. A witness must believe his testimony firmly enough to actually carry out the execution himself. And in some cases, this might discourage the false testimony. So, you know, there was a certain, it goes on, and there's all kinds of other bits and pieces there, and about disfiguring bodies, and about, you know, how the body was to be hung or not hung, and the how the body must be let down at certain times, and all this kind of thing. And it was under Jewish law now, and I'm not saying that's the way this law is to be applied, but it is interesting that when people who were applying this applied it, they were doing it in as humane a fashion as they could, and the way in which it was applied was so that the body was not degraded. It was not something which was actually caused, because we are made in the image of God. In the image of God made he him. That was actually brought out in Genesis. So they apply all these various scriptures to the situation of stoning. Now another aspect of witness, being a witness, if you turn over a couple of pages to Deuteronomy 19, in Deuteronomy 19, if you have a look in verse 15, it says, Deuteronomy 19 verse 15, it says, "One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin in any sin that he sins. At the mouth of two witnesses or the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established." So again, this is re-emphasized, not only just for the murder, but for any particular occurrence, and that is not being applied in today's society. And yet we've got to make sure that we understand this, if we're going to be judging correctly. "If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him, that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Eternal, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition. And behold, if the witness be a false witness, and has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So shall you put away the evil from among you. And those which remain will hear and fear, and henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And your eyes shall not pity, but life will go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." So it was the application of this particular law that basically stopped false witnesses. And again, you do not find that within today's society. This aspect of God's law is just simply not applied. The judgment that would be made against, say, Abu Hamza, if that was a false witness that actually came against him, perhaps in an American court, say, they do not have in place this law, which would mean that that person that went against him, say, for his life, would lose their lives, or for a life imprisonment, would go into life imprisonment themselves. So whatever it is that is necessary to convict somebody, this aspect also should be in place in the law of God, which is a just and a fair way of action. Again, on human terms, I'm not talking about the spiritual, the application of the Spirit of God. I mean, that's another matter itself, and we're looking in the future of the application of God's Spirit and the application of the forgiveness as well. Now if you look over in Leviticus 24, Leviticus 24, there was a case for prison as such. Leviticus 24 verse 12, verse 10, "And the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian went out among the children of Israel, and two people strove in the camp, and the Israelite woman's son blasphemed the name of the Eternal and cursed, and they brought him to Moses in his mother's name," and so on, "and they put him in ward," they put him into a place of restraint. In other words, they put him between perhaps two soldiers, or they put him in a place where he's not going to be able to get out of, "that the mind of the Eternal maybe showed them, and the Eternal spoke to Moses saying." So there was a place for prison in a sense of restraining somebody, but it wasn't very long. It was just while the judicial process, which was very, very quick, would in fact take place. Now, if you contrast that with Babylon, if you turn over to Isaiah 14, there's another scripture actually which I could have also read, which I haven't not jotted down. But anyway, Isaiah 14, let's see. Here we're looking at Babylon verse 4. It says that you will take up the proverb against the king of Babylon. There was the one that is behind the Babylon of yesteryear, and also the Babylonish system that we're actually going to be under in the future and today. And then verse 12, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning?" So we're talking about this light bringer, this Hallel, the light of God, which is contrasted with Michael and Gabriel, And we're talking about Satan. But notice what it says in verse 17. It says, that made the world as a wilderness, and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners. In other words, life sentences were handed out. And this was an aspect, if you like, that was brought out within this passage in Isaiah 14 regarding prisons. And it was something which was, you know, you don't find within the way of God. The being put in ward was a very, very short stay, and then the judgment was carried out, whether he was beating, whether it was a execution or whatever it was. But that is the way of God, so you don't have this this problem. If you just think about this thing with Abba Hanza, and you think about the actual cost to the state, if it does go across to the United States and he is tried over there, I looked on the internet to try and find some kind of an idea of what it costs to keep somebody in prison. And I got this Department of Legislative Services in Maryland, General Assembly, 2001 fiscal note, which is House Bill 749, about vehicle laws and leaving the scene of an accident. And they were changing the law regarding leaving the scene of an accident and stiffening the penalty, and doubling actually the penalty. And they were then doing a fiscal analysis to see what the cost would be to the state if they actually passed this law and went ahead and increased the length of sentence. And in this particular, you know, I won't go into all the details, the amounts, you know, the actual details of that particular crime, but it says currently the average total cost per inmate, so here's the total cost per inmate, including overhead, is estimated at $1,700 per month. Now that's how much it costs to keep somebody in prison. So you're looking at over $20,000 per year to keep somebody in prison, if my calculation is right. It says, this bill alone, however, should not create the need for additional funds and beds and so on, facilities, excluding the overhead, it goes down to $288 per month. Now, what exactly they've taken out to get it down to that figure is debatable. Medical costs, actually looking after the particular inmate, the food and the housing, you know, the food and the actual heating and this kind of thing is probably in there. But I doubt if it includes prison warders' salaries and that kind of thing. So we can see that it is quite an expensive business. Again, that is not the way of God. That's not the way God's word indicates it should be done. The actual cost just for this one man, and he will probably be a special category, I would imagine would be at least that. It probably would be a good deal more than that because of the special category nature. It's not only just keeping him in, it's keeping other people out that would be going in to try and free him. It looks as if it could be a fair amount more than that. Other areas, there's also something else that came up again yesterday in the in a number of locations. There was one in today's paper from the Daily Telegraph. It says warders place bets on fights between inmates, claims that prison officers at troubled young offenders institutions deliberately place aggressive inmates in cells and then bet on the fights between them are being examined. So this also is coming up to show that these places are not godly. These places are just not right. The BBC News had an article on it, and that was yesterday. And the Guardian, which is tends to be quite a liberal paper, had an article on it yesterday. It says detectives have investigated claims that prison officers at a young offenders institute organized bets on fights between black and white inmates that emerged last night. Officers at Feltham Young Offenders Institute in West London are said to have put white and black youths in the same cells and bet on how long it would be before they attacked each other. And the allegations in the Sun newspaper come at the same week that a public inquiry was opened and adjourned into the fate of a 19-year-old Zahid Mubarak, who was beaten to death by a white cellmate in Feltham in March 2000. So, you know, it is within the scope of this murder that you're looking at this particular allegation. where and this Mubarak apparently had been serving 90 days for stealing £6 worth of razor blades, which really, and then he ends up murdered because the prison guards, when they hadn't made, did what they did, and put him with somebody who had Ku Klux Klan's insignia all over his cell and tattoos on his forehead and all the rest of it. So it was done deliberately. It was something which, you know, we just really should understand is not a godly way. However, you turn over to Psalm 110, I've read it many times, but in Psalm 110, be aware that when Christ returns, and he is the King, and he would says, the Eternal said to my Lord, my Adonai, in verse 1, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool, until this government in fact does intervene. And the start of that, the rod of the strength, and will rule out of the midst, in the midst of your enemies, the strength coming out of Zion. Zion often is referred to the church. Your people will be willing in the day of your power and the beauties of holiness. You're a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, who blessed Abraham at the return of the slaughter. The Lord at your right hand, that's Christ at the right hand of the power on high, shall strike through kings in the day of his wrath. He'll judge among the nations. He will fill the places with dead bodies. He will wound the heads of many countries and the drink in the brook of the way. So within this prophecy, which within this psalm, we can see that Christ is not going to mess around when it comes to this administration of justice and judgment. But there is another side as well, and that is that our job primarily, although yes, we will need to administer God's form of justice and God's form of judgment within the world tomorrow, the idea is not to wipe people out. It is to be firm, to be, rule them with a rod of iron in that sense. But nevertheless, it is also to change the heart of man, to have them to, and we'll be going into this in the day of Pentecost, which is tomorrow. And that is the purpose. That's what we've got to learn. That's the difficult thing. You know, learning these laws and applying these laws strictly, that is not the most difficult thing. You simply learn the law and apply them. I mean, we've got lawyers and judges and things in this world that do that kind of thing, or are able to do that kind of thing. And certainly they should in fact be doing that with the laws, which are righteous laws, which have come from God. There's an article in the Reader's Digest. It says, you can't make this stuff up. It says, during a recent trip to the United States, I noticed a sign in the reception area of an office building. It read, don't even think of smoking here. Now, I think that smoking is a disgusting habit, but my first thought was, how on earth are they going to enforce that? They'd have to rely on people furtively sliding up to the receptionist saying things like, I'm terribly sorry, but I thought of smoking a cigarette just then. And surely this is a pointless notice to hang on any wall. Or is it? And he goes on, he says, a few months ago, a 49-year-old Japanese man decided to give himself up to the police because he was, quote, thinking of doing a robbery, unquote. Apparently, he had just made redundant and was in debt, so he'd set his little heart on raiding a post office, and he hadn't counted on his guilty feelings, though, or the fact that he'd be arrested for conspiracy to commit a crime. Now he has no job and a criminal record, and there are a few bigger fans of honesty and honor than me, but I still think that's taking a thing a little too far. But you know, that is what we're talking about. You know, this is the way, walk in it. When you turn to your right and turn to the left, it is a case of what's going on in the mind, training people to have a mind that is turned to the way of God and to the Word of God. And it is. It's interesting. I was reading an article about this film. I can't remember what the name is. Johnny somebody or other. I can't remember the name of it, but it's about a kind of a spoof spy. It was Rowan Atkinson who was the star of the show, and this spoof. Can anybody remember that name of that film? Johnny something or other. I'm sure Estelle and Andrew are yelling it at me at the moment, but. Anyway, this spoof spy, and apparently it was being shown in cinemas up and down the country, And the children would laugh at all the various jokes, some of the jokes and bits and pieces. But the one place where the entire adult audience just got up and cheered was where he was driving down the road, and suddenly a speed camera from behind flashed him. So he obviously he was over the limit. So he kind of pressed a button on his dashboard, and two bazooka rockets came out the back and blew the thing to smithereens. So we all of us, if we are looking at thinking of doing a crime, we are all guilty, guilty. And really, in that area, I must admit, I am as well, because I think when I first thought about that, I mean, that certainly would appeal in many ways. But that is really what we're looking for. We're looking for a time when really the heart of man is changed. That's what it's all about, and that's what we must be concentrating on, and certainly going into the day of Pentecost, which will be tomorrow. But I thought it'd be worthwhile just concentrating on what's going on in the news in this legal area, and just reading a few scriptures regarding God's way in this area, and just seeing the kind of contrast between them might be helpful to everyone.